I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera.
The trademark song from the woman born Doris Kappelhoff. You, of course, and millions around the world know her as Doris Day, considered the top female movie star of all time. She was a movie star. She was a singer. She was a wife. She was a mother. She was a animal activist. And she was, to so many Americans, the personification of the girl next door. But it was a title that she didn't like and didn't live. Joining us right now, David Kaufman. He is the author of Doris Day, The Untold Story of the Girl Next Door from Virgin Books. He is a theater critic and contributor to the New York Times. His previous book was Ridiculous, The Theatrical Life and Times of Charles Ludlam. David Kaufman, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ted. Thanks a lot.
Tell me why you decided to write this book. What about Doris Day and what surrounded her was untold from her own autobiography?
Oh, my God. That's quite a place to begin. That isn't why I – my primary motivation for writing this book was because I felt for much of my own life that she was underestimated as an actress,
mm-hmm.
not as much as a singer. I think she's been more recognized for her vocal abilities than for her acting skills. But I also knew that – I don't know of any memoir that really tells the whole story. Even if they're completely candid, they lack the perspective of an outsider. They can't really be objective. So I wanted to discover the story. I wanted to find out where Doris Day fit into the context of the times that she was living. And they were wonderful times, actually, for certainly for this country, the 1950s, the 1960s. That was her heyday, and it was really our country was thriving. And I think Doris Day represented us to the rest of the world. And I think at this point, in fact, one of the things I learned, which astonished me, is that even today, she is, I think, much more popular in the United Kingdom than she is here. There are three different Doris Day fan clubs in the UK.
Why do you think that is?
I think it has something to do with what I was just kind of talking around, that it's because she represented us. And I think that at that particular point in time when she was representing us to the world, I think Great Britain was in love with us too, and they looked up to us. And I think she also represented what America represented, which is this upbeat, happy-go-lucky, you know, on-top-of-the-world attitude.
So that Girl Next Door title said more about us than it did
well,
about her.
No. It definitely said a lot about her because those were the roles that she played. And her third of four husbands and most – her third and most significant of four husbands – was her manager first, and he was her manager throughout. And he really manipulated her image, and that was the image he wanted her to be.
Talking about Marty Melcher.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting. You talk about her being underrated as a film star, and one of the interesting things I found in your book is that when Hollywood first noticed her, she actually felt she wasn't ready yet.
Well, she was insecure about the way she looked. And her whole life, she was insecure about the way she looked. And I think that that has everything to do with a bad relationship with her father, who just wasn't there for her very much when she was growing up and abandoned her and her mother and brother when she was a teenager. Which means that she felt that she could not please anybody enough. And it's sad because the whole world considered her so beautiful. And it's sad that she has lived with this burden. I think she also was – I know that she was also insecure about her talents as well. She was extremely – this was a big surprise to me to discover just how nervous she was about performing in public. Performing for the camera was easy for her. And performing in front of people was not. And even though – can be 100 people on a movie set, Doris still herself talked about how somehow it was different. It wasn't the same. There are several anecdotes from people I interviewed who knew her well, worked with her, illustrating this point, her insecurity.
How much was that based on the competing starlets of the day?
I'm not sure that I understand the question.
Well, that she felt insecure about her looks compared to the other beautiful movie stars that she was competing with for roles.
I think that there's probably some of that, but I really think it was more psychologically rooted than that. I think it goes deeper, and I think it does have a lot to do with what I was just saying about her bad relationship with her father. On the other hand, she had a wonderful relationship with her mother. For in a sense, she could do no wrong for her mother. She could do no – her father simply was vacant. He wasn't there.
And doing some psychological analysis here, do you believe that had something to do with her married life and the men she chose, at least a couple of which were abusive?
Ultimately, unfortunately, all four of her marriages were unhappy. The first two were very short-lived. They were each – a year, roughly a year long. The marriage to Melcher is from 1952. He dies in 68. So that's more, 15, 16 years. He died very young because he picked up Christian Science from Doris Day, who picked up Christian Science from her second husband when they were no longer married, actually, a man named George Weidler, whose sister Virginia many people would recognize as Norma Shearer's daughter in the movie The Women and as Katharine Hepburn's sister in the movie The Philadelphia Story. But I'm not sure if I answered your question sufficiently or not. I guess I got a little sidetracked.
No, it was just about whether her choices in men was a reflection of her father and the fact that he wasn't there.
I think the sad thing is that she her whole life basically had dysfunctional family situations. She claims in her memoir that she did not love Marty Melcher. She did not marry him out of love.
And that he became more of a father, as you write in your book, than a husband.
And she has also said years later that it was a mistake to marry somebody who was her manager and who was more like a father to her.
And Marty, go ahead.
And, you know, getting back to my feeling that she's underrated and underestimated as an actress, one of the things I came to discover, because she made 39 pictures in 20 years, which is kind of astonishing, and the first 17 at Warner Brothers in 5 or 6 years, 7 years, I guess, which is even more amazing. But unfortunately, the last handful of movies that she made, I think, are really not very good. She herself is good in them, but I think that that's one of the reasons why she doesn't have the reputation she deserves, because it's those last movies that the world was sort of left with the image of Doris Day. She made so many terrific earlier films, many of which I never saw till I started researching this book. Just before Marty Melcher died, Mike Nichols approached Doris Day to make to be Mrs. Robinson in The Graduate.
Which was a seminal moment in her career.
If only Melcher would have let her do that, I think it would have taken her into a whole other level. She would have had another film career beyond where it ended.
Which leads to my next question. How much credit and blame does Marty Melcher, as her third husband, as her manager, get for her career, for the image as the girl next door, for her good and bad film choices?
He gets a good deal of the credit, which he earned. I mean, he knew what he was doing in some ways, but it's interesting because what I discovered by reading different interviews over the years with Doris, throughout her life she vacillates between saying that she doesn't know where this image came from, she doesn't know why it's there, and there were other times she told people that she had to make these movies because if she didn't, she would disappoint her fans, and she had to adhere to that image. She couldn't.
So she was aware it was her bread and butter.
Clearly, she was. But she was, and she colluded with Marty in creating that. In addition to my having interviewed so very many people, a number of whom were close to Doris, either as friends or as colleagues. One of the greatest discoveries was something at the Margaret Herrick Library here in L.A. It's the Jane Ardmore papers. Jane Ardmore was a woman who wrote for the movie magazines, but she became very close to Doris. Doris would go over to her house, and Jane was interviewing Doris over, I guess, 12-year period. And Doris was sharing with her real feelings about everything, about the past, the present, and the future as they were occurring. I think that that's where the real memoir is, because when she wrote her memoir with A.E. Hotchner, she was looking back on 1975. With Jane Ardmore, she also felt unguarded because Jane Ardmore had to run every piece by Doris and Marty. Those papers include things that Doris wrote in the margins. They also include Jane Ardmore's notes. They include unpublished pieces. They include all the interview transcripts. So it was a real treasure trove for a biographer. And I was very fortunate in that her relatives who control the estate gave me permission to quote from them.
We're talking with author David Kaufman. The book is Doris Day, The Untold Story of the Girl Next Door from Virgin Books. He is a contributor to the New York Times, and his last book was Ridiculous, The Theatrical Life and Times of Charles Ludlam. Talk about a couple of her first two films, Calamity Jane, Young at Heart, which really kind of put her on the map as an actress.
Well, she has, at different points in her life, said that Calamity Jane is her favorite film, and at one point she said, Calamity Jane is me, that's who I am. I think it's one of her best films. Young at Heart is the only film she made with Frank Sinatra, but she actually had worked with Sinatra some years earlier on his radio program in New York. And she has talked about how hard it was for her to do those performances because that was in front of a huge audience. Getting back to her insecurities, Mitch Miller, the first person I interviewed for this book 8 years ago, was her A&R man at Columbia for 10 years. And he saw her in her first and last cabaret act, and he told me in 1947, and he told me that she was vomiting backstage before going on.
We'll be back in just a moment with author David Kaufman and his biography of Doris Day, and we'll talk about Doris's seminal films, including Pillow Talk and The Man Who Knew Too Much, and her strong relationship with Rock Hudson. That's all coming up on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Air Talk.
Programming supported by the Southern California Mercedes-Benz dealers, offering test drives of their full line of luxury sedans, coupes, convertibles, roadsters, and trucks during the Summer Love event now through July 31st. You can build your own Benz at mbsocal.com.
This is 89.3 KPCC Traffic and Weather at kpcc.org. The former treasurer of a parents' booster group at Emerson Middle School in West L.A. is out on bail after being arrested on suspicion of stealing $65,000 raised by parents and students. The L.A. Times reports the suspect is 44-year-old James Marzullo, a real estate agent. The second day of a Southland heat wave was a perfect one for the L.A. 84 Foundation to begin the 23rd summer of its Learn to Swim program. The program offers free swimming lessons to about 10,000 Southland kids every summer. KPCC's Brian Watt paddled over to the swim stadium at LA's Exposition Park.
To demonstrate that it's never too early to feel at home in the water, Olympic gold medalist Janet Evans and her 20-month-old daughter Sydney took a dip in the pool. Evans, who's also a board member of the LA 84 Foundation, said drowning is the leading cause of accidental death for children 5 years old and younger.
And having parents bring their kids, bring your children to the pool to teach them how to swim and give them the opportunity to be pool safe is literally a lifesaver.
13-year-old Khalif Muhammad of South Los Angeles started swim classes when he was 8. Now he's a junior lifeguard.
If you can't swim, it's going to be hard because you might not feel good about yourself.
A recent survey from USA Swimming, the sport's national governing body, suggests that Khalif's an exception. It indicates that 6 of 10 black and Latino children in this country don't know how to swim. Brian Watt, 89.3 KPCC.
It's 11:21 at 89.3 KPCC.
Please, please don't eat.
Here I am waiting and anticipating the kisses that I... Doris Day singing Please Don't Eat the Daisies from the 1960 film of the same name starring Doris Day and David Niven. We continue our conversation with David Kaufman. He is the author of the new book, Doris Day, The Untold Story of the Girl Next Door from Virgin Books. I want to move into one of Doris Day's biggest films and one she was very excited about, and that was working with Alfred Hitchcock in the 1956 film The Man Who Knew Too Much. And in this scene, Doris Day and James Stewart, they play a married couple on vacation in Morocco with their 8-year-old son Hank, and here the couple tries to figure out the family's next move.
Why didn't you give this to the police?
Because I didn't want to.
But Ben, a man's life...
It's at stake, yeah, I know. I don't know what's the right thing to do.
Look, I think we should go back to the hotel, pick up Hank, and get out of here as quickly as we can.
Maybe.
Darling, think about Hank. What a terrible thing this is for him, seeing a man murdered right before his eyes. It's a horrible shock to a little boy.
I know.
Well, why don't you take that note, give it to the American consulate, and let's not get any more involved, please.
One of the interesting things you write about is how Doris Day was not the cool blonde, as you put it, that Alfred Hitchcock normally chooses, and that she was pretty nervous about taking this on.
Well, she realized how important Hitchcock was as a director. She also realized that she's, apart from singing Que Sera Sera in the film, this was not a musical. It was a dramatic role. And she ended up giving one of the strongest performances of her career. She's magnificent in the part. And it is, incidentally, the first film I remember seeing as a little boy when it came out. And it's when I first fell in love with her myself, actually. But one of the really interesting things I learned was just how hard it was for her to work with Hitchcock. And that gets back to what you were just saying. Once again, this speaks to her insecurities, I think. But for her, the problem was that Hitchcock was not telling her anything. And she thought it's because he didn't like what she was doing. So she went to Jimmy Stewart, who had already worked with Hitchcock a couple of times.
Rear Window and
Vertigo, I believe.
Rope or Vertigo. Yeah.
In any event, he told her, well – if he had any problems, he would be telling you. But everything's fine. Don't worry about it. Doris did something she rarely does. This is the only film that she shot overseas. It was shot in London and in Morocco. And she was afraid of flying ever since she had so many near misses working with Bob Hope in the late 40s that she had been left with the fear of flying the rest of her life. She went to Europe by ship, not by plane. In any event...
Afraid of flying to this day.
Well, yeah. And she did fly again to London. She went to London with her very good friend. How can I be blanking on her name? The author of Valley of the Dolls. But I was trying to get back to the train of thought I had a minute ago.
Well, let me ask you about Que Sera Sera, which is so... ingrained in everybody's consciousness and associated with her. She didn't necessarily like the song at first.
She did not. She did not think it was going to be – she certainly didn't think it was going to become the hit that it did. She didn't even want to do it. But her husband recognized its merits, and so did Hitchcock. And interesting thing about that song is the people who wrote it, Hitchcock told them what he was looking for in the song, and they went home and wrote it in – half an hour or something like that, but they decided that they'd wait a couple of weeks to give it to him because they didn't want him to know how easily and quickly it came to them.
Let's talk about Day's probably most famous film and her most famous on-screen partner. In this scene from the 1959 film Pillow Talk, Doris Day and Rock Hudson's characters talk for the first time on the phone line, the party line that their two homes share.
Miss Morrow, why are you so fascinated with my personal affairs?
I'm not fascinated, Mr. Allen. Revolted.
You don't see me going down to the phone company complaining about your affairs.
I have none to complain about.
It figures.
What do you mean it figures?
Well, obviously, you're a woman who lives alone, doesn't like it.
I happen to like living alone.
Look, I don't know what's bothering you, but don't take your bedroom problems out on me.
I have no bedroom problems. There's nothing in my bedroom that bothers me.
Oh, that's too bad.
Mr. Allen, let's try to be adult about this and work out some sort of schedule where I can make my business calls and you can make your... whatever you call the calls you make.
Such obvious chemistry. And you write about how one of the reasons they got along so well is that they were so different from their public personas.
Exactly. I think that Doris was as close to Rock Hudson as she was to anybody. They adored each other. They just loved each other. And I think that this goes back to the image of the girl next door, he the macho male. I don't know that they ever discussed it, but I think that they could relate so well to each other. Also at the time, they were both – he was the number one male star. She was the number one female star. But they realized that they were the – essentially the opposite to the images. They – and that's one of the reasons I think they did not call each other Doris and Rock. He called her Eunice. She called him Ernie. Mm-hmm. They wrote each other fan letters as if from fans by other names. They played games with each other a lot.
You write that everyone in the studio knew that Rock Hudson was gay, but I seem to remember at some point that she said she didn't know. So did she know? Did she not know?
I don't say that everybody in the studio knew. I said most people in Hollywood knew.
Okay.
But they colluded in keeping it a secret. I have been told by some people close to Doris that she did know. I don't know where she ever said that she didn't know. But it wasn't something she would ever talk about. She would never talk about such a thing with anybody.
Unfortunately, we're getting close to running out of time.
Oh,
I want to flash
God.
Forward to that moment that so many of us remember when she was with Rock Hudson promoting her cable show, and he was obviously so ill from AIDS at that point. What was that moment like for her?
Oh, it was harrowing because she had no idea how ill he was until she saw him. Nobody knew that he had AIDS except for himself, and he didn't even tell his manager that it was AIDS, I think, until later that night. But the whole world realized. There had started to be rumors because some people had seen him. But Doris did not know until she saw him when he came to help promote the last show she had, which was called Best Friends, a cable show in 1985. And he was to be her first guest, and she ended up showing it later. Between the time that he did shoot it and the time that it aired, he died of AIDS. He went to France where he was going to hopefully get a cure, but it didn't happen.
What do we know about Doris Day today?
We know that she's alive and well in Carmel, and she still is involved with her pet causes. It's the thing that matters the most to her. I went into this project knowing she wouldn't talk to me because she will not talk about the past. But I also did write her a letter. She's known about the book for 3 years, and she did nothing to put up any barriers to prevent anybody from talking to me, and she knows a number of people who have.
Thank you so much, David Kaufman, author of Doris Day, The Untold Story of the Girl Next Door, theater critic and contributor to the New York Times. The book is from Virgin Books. And welcome back to our Film Week portion of Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. And it's time to review the week's new movies with critics Leo Lowenstein from Variety and Claudia Puig from USA Today. Our first film, the highly anticipated Get Smart, a reimagining, remaking, whatever you want to call it, of the 1960s television series, of course, starring the famous, at the time, Don Adams and Barbara Feldon in the major roles. The film stars Steve Carell, Anne Hathaway, Dwayne Johnson, and Alan Arkin, is directed by Peter Segal, and is written by Tom Asel and Matt Ember, based on characters created by Mel Brooks and Buck Henry for that TV show. And in this scene, Max, who is undercover and played by Steve Carell, confronts Siegfried, played by Terrence Stamp.
Who are you?
My name is Nudnik Shpilkas.
Who are you?
I am Siegfried.
I understand that you're the man to see if someone is interested in acquiring items of a nuclear nature.
How do I know you're not Control?
If I were Control, you'd already be dead.
If you were Control, you'd already be dead.
Well, neither of us is dead, so I'm obviously not from Control.
That actually makes sense.
I love that clip from the trailer. Lael, you go first. Does this film hit the mark, or does it miss it by
I'm
that much?
I'm afraid it missed it even by a little more than that much. I didn't find it terribly funny. I thought it sort of suffered from a bit of kind of schizophrenia. It didn't really know what it wanted to be, whether it was trying to be a goofy spy caper or actually more like a slick kind of suspense thriller or whatever. It seemed to sort of be all over the place, and I was struck with the realization, well, why are they remaking this? Because it didn't seem particularly timely for now. It didn't seem like it wasn't it was the original series was fun, but you know, this was just,
and why contemporize it?
Yeah,
you
why
know, part of it was that it was of its time,
right?
And you know, I think to make it in contemporary times didn't work, and also it could have used more of the sly wit of Buck Henry and Mel Brooks.
Right.
It was just, you know, I mean, yeah, you had the sorry missed it by that much, and sorry about that, Chief, and you know, would you believe? But it was really generic, I thought.
Yeah, the lines were there, but the delivery wasn't right, and there was just something, I don't know, maybe even in the chemistry between Steve Carell and Anne Hathaway that was missing.
Their
a bit.
Chemistry was okay, but it was nothing like the chemistry of Don Adams and Barbara Feldon.
Exactly.
I mean, maybe that's part of the problem, is that we remember the show very fondly, and it was a really seminal show.
You know,
but I love Steve Carell in other things.
Yeah, I do too.
I've also not liked him in some things too, but I mean, if he had brought some of that sort of darker, edgier humor from The Office, I think that would have made
There wasn't enough big edge. Difference. Maybe that was the problem. There was just really no edge.
So it felt like just one example of Hollywood mining for old TV shows and just kind of throwing something together.
Exactly.
Yeah,
very
not mining very creatively, just sort of looking at something that's already there and not really putting much of a whole new take on it.
No, I mean, there were some good moments. I thought Alan Arkin as the Chief actually did a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm.
And then they threw in Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Right.
You know, sort of, I guess he was the one that he idolized or whatever. But generally it did feel like Hollywood just, you know, kind of desperately scraping around going, oh, this was a show people liked. And, you know, and if we put Steve Carell, and you know, it wasn't like he was trying to do Don Adams, which maybe is a wise choice not
right.
to do that. But still, I just think that it's not terrible. It's just not really worthy of your time and money.
Exactly.
You mentioned the balance between trying to hit the action mark and also do comedy at the same time.
Yes.
And was there too much action at the expense of the comedy?
I would say it's particularly towards the latter part of the film. It was just kind of absurd.
I felt there was too much action. I felt like there should have been more comedy. It's tough to blend those two things,
and it
really couldn't decide whether it wanted to be. I think it thought the filmmakers thought that by, you know, because it's a summer blockbuster, you know, and they kind of had that on their minds. It's like, this is what a summer blockbuster has. It has all this explosive action,
right.
And then, you know, it has sort of quips. But I think you need to have more situational humor.
Exactly.
This seemed to be
totally
viewed as a test for Steve Carell as a leading man after Evan Almighty didn't succeed as well.
Oh, he's been a leading man. I mean, he was in Dan in Real Life.
Right.
I mean,
that did okay.
Yeah. I think he can do it. You know, and I think he's fantastic in Little Miss Sunshine. He was fantastic in 40-Year-Old Virgin. Certainly in The Office. When he's at the top of his game. But I think it really depends on what's
it's the material.
Writing.
The material. The writing, the material. And this just wasn't the right material.
No.
All right, the film is Get Smart, starring Steve Carell and Anne Hathaway and Dwayne Johnson, opens in theaters today. Our next film is the other big comedy opening this weekend, and there was a lot written about these two films going head-to-head, which has been planned a year in advance, and neither studio, Warner Brothers or Paramount, budged on the release date of Love Guru. He is a comedy about an American played by Mike Myers who's raised by gurus in Asia. He returns to the U.S., into the, of course, self-help industry to reunite a hockey star with his ex-wife. It stars Mike Myers, Jessica Alba, Justin Timberlake, and Ben Kingsley, and directed by Marco Schnabel and written by Myers and Graham Gordy, rated PG-13. In this clip, Pitka, Mike Myers, gives advice to Prudence, played by Megan Good, about her love life.
Jacques Grande, is he Mr. Right or Mr. Right Now?
Jacques and I get along just fine.
You have what we call in the guru business, love without knowledge. But what you had with Darren is love with knowledge, a real connection.
Hey! I said stay away from the girl.
Rajneesh, let's make like a baby and head out.
So, Claudia, this film was a product of Meyer's quest for spiritual enlightenment after the death of his father, and
right.
and thus his linking with Deepak Chopra, which is this film, I guess, is an homage to. Did it work?
Well, yeah. You know, interestingly enough, I just picked up Deepak Chopra's latest book here in the radio station, and he dedicated it to Mike Myers. So they must have some kind of friendship there. Or he's hoping that maybe this will lead people to read more of his books. But, you know, there were moments that were funny in a really silly way. It's very broad humor, very silly humor. You know, it just, I think that he says these kind of, some of the sort of satire of spiritual enlightenment, self-help books like Chopra's is certainly, you know, ripe fodder for satire and lampooning. And he does these little meaningless kind of, sort of profundities, like, I want you to go from nowhere to now here. And his book is called I Know You Are, But What Am I? You know, I mean, so those things are kind of cute and funny. And he does this thing, instead of namaste, he greets people with Mariska Hargitay.
Yeah.
So, you know, I laughed a few times despite myself, but it also has so many, like, just the bathroom humor. It's just replete with bathroom humor. More penis jokes than I think I've ever heard in one movie. You know, just really kind of silliness, grossness for the sake of it.
Well, you
agree? You know, I wouldn't even give it that much credit, Claudia. I feel like this is one of the worst movies to come out this year.
Ouch.
Or any year. And, I mean, talk about spiritual enlightenment. I had an epiphany during the course of watching the film, which was, if this is the kind of movies that Hollywood is making, I might have to find another career.
Whoa.
Because I'm telling you, to sit there and at something that was just so wretched and just execrable that there was nothing redeeming about it. I mean, was it the sight of Vern Troyer being used as a hockey puck? Was it the jousting with the urine-soaked mops? Was it the sight of two elephants having intercourse on the hockey rink that was used for laughs? I mean, defecating, all the penis jokes.
Yeah.
I mean, there were so many. And I think there can be a place for offensive humor. I think that when it's done, when it's well conceived and well executed, it can be funny. But this was just so sloppy, and
it was sloppy, and it wasn't in any way funny. It wasn't pushing the envelope like Borat or something like
that. Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, exactly. If you're going to do it, you have to push the envelope. And this just felt like Mike Myers trying to reclaim his former glory and not coming anywhere close.
I want to talk about the film a little bit more when we come back, in terms of in the pantheon of Mike Myers and his long breaks between films, with the exception of the Shrek movies.
Right.
And we'll also review Kit Kittredge American Girl, which will be exciting because we have two mothers in the house, which is based on the popular American Girl series. That's all coming up on the Film Week portion of Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Torrance Cultural Arts Center, presenting Christopher Cross Friday, June 27th. This special show will feature all his classic 1980s Grammy and Oscar winning hits, plus a gourmet dinner, live and silent auctions, dancing under the stars, and a champagne reception. Proceeds benefit the arts in the South Bay. Tickets to this evening with Christopher Cross are available now at torrancearts.com.
This is 89.3 KPCC election coverage on air and online at kpcc.org. California politicians continue to support a moratorium on oil drilling off the coast, but a ban on new drilling in South Los Angeles is poised to end next week. The company PXP has long operated wells in the Baldwin Hills oil field, and it's applied for permission to start new taps in the area. The oil field's neighbors say they're worried an LA County planning process won't adequately consider the environmental and health risks of drilling. Lark Galloway-Gilliam of Community Health Council says 60 days for public comment won't be long enough.
We really need to study this carefully because we can't start from scratch. We can't start from a blank slate. And we definitely don't want to simply use what the operator, PXP, has proposed as a standard. We think we need to raise the bar.
The first public meeting about what's in the report is scheduled for mid-July. It's 11:41.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, presenting the 14th recent Spanish Cinema Festival, featuring 12 U.S. and Los Angeles premieres of new films from Spain. Actors and directors will appear in person with these International Film Festival and Goya Award winners. June 12th to the 22nd, online at EgyptianTheater.com.
Welcome back to Film Week on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC with critics Leah Lowenstein of Variety and Claudia Puig from USA Today. We're reviewing the week's new releases, and coming up in just a little bit, we're going to talk about Kit Kittredge and American Girl, which a lot of young ladies are looking forward to and no doubt rushing to the theaters to see. But I wanted to continue our discussion of The Love Guru, the Mike Myers vehicle that was opening this weekend. And the question I want to throw out there, I know, Leo, you pretty much hated it.
Glad completely.
You didn't much
I didn't like it, but I didn't hate it as much as you
either.
Did.
But there's been much written about Mike Myers. This is his first live action film, with the exception, of course, of the Shrek films in a while. And the question raised is whether his brand of comedy, which is so distinct in the 90s, can carry over to today, where so much of the tone of broad-based comedy has changed. I'm wondering.
I think he is a little bit on the wane. Little pun on Wayne's World there. no, I think that a lot of people think he's kind of, you know, dying. And it's funny because it comes a week after M. Night Shyamalan, who I also think is on the wane. Yeah, I mean, these people that were, you know, 90s phenomenons or phenomena. But,
well, I think, you know, the Will Ferrell situation reminds me a little bit of Mike Myers as well, in that I think Will Ferrell has been recycling these very similar personae for a few years now, and he's going to have to get out of that rut because people are not going to keep coming back to see variations on stupid athletes, you know,
right,
for too long. And I feel like Mike Myers has been doing something like that too. He's trying
to catch
some
sort of
cultural
zeitgeist,
but he's not. Yeah, he can. I do think Will Ferrell can, but I think Mike Myers has got to figure out what he wants to become or do, because this isn't working.
So much resides on the character itself that he creates. And when I first saw that character, I don't know that I necessarily saw the potential as I did in Austin Powers.
Right. I think you're right. I think Austin Powers had a little more potential. I mean, it's kind of a Saturday Night Live sketch. And as a sketch, it would have been fine.
Right.
Because there's enough humor you could milk, you know, for 10, 15 minutes. But I don't think it withstand, you know, can withstand an entire movie. The plot was so thin. I mean, it wasn't really a plot.
No.
And, you know, he has some moments that he can be kind of funny, and some of them come so quickly that you lose them. Like, he did something where he described something as lugubrious, and it was a funny turn of phrase, and it was kind of clever, but it just kind of got lost in the shuffle of bathroom humor.
Yeah.
And how is Justin Timberlake? Does he have
a future
as an actor?
I think he has a future. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, so. Just the one bright spot in this dark morass with Justin Timberlake. He's incredibly charismatic. He's not bad to look at. He moves beautifully. Yeah. He seems to engage the camera well.
He shows he not only can he do comedy, which I think he's proven on Saturday Night Live and here, but I think he can also do drama. We were talking about Black Snake Moan during the break and Alpha Dog. I think he does have a future.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
The biggest reason, Claudia, your daughter took you to go see The Love Guru, correct?
She took me to see Justin Timberlake.
That's
in
right.
Concert.
You told me.
Yeah.
Okay. And speaking of daughters, that was my transition to our
nice
next
segue.
Film,
nice segue.
And having two moms in the studio, Kit Kittredge and American Girl. Which is based on the hugely popular American Girl dolls and books. It is the story of Kit, a 10-year-old girl growing up in Cincinnati during the Great Depression, someone who loves to write and dreams of having the local paper print her work. It stars Abigail Breslin in the title role, also Joan Cusack, Glenn Headley, Chris O'Donnell as a dad. Wow.
Yeah.
Julia Ormond and Stanley Tucci, directed by Patricia Rosema. Directed Mansfield Park and written by Ann Peacock. And here, Kit, Abigail Breslin, pitches her story to the paper's editor, played by Wallace Shawn.
Who is it?
Margaret Mildred Kittredge.
What do you want?
To be in print.
Well, how do I say this nicely?
But you haven't even read it!
She's sorry, Mr. Gibson. Come on, Kit.
Yeah, that's right. I am sorry. I'm sorry you can't recognize a good story when it's standing right outside your door.
What did you say?
Portrait of a boarding house, sir. It's fresh. It's new. It's real. What you're holding in your hand, sir, is the story you've been looking for. And you can throw me out if you want, but I suggest that you read it first. A Kid's Eye View of the Depression in Cincinnati by Kit Kittredge, age 10.
Lil, you have a daughter who's 6. Claudia, you have a daughter who's 14. So you're both right outside kind of that target age range, but you're both fans of American Girl.
Well, and I think we both took our daughters, and my daughter, Ava, loved it. I have to say she was not initiated into the cult of American Girl. She does not have an American Girl doll. And I was actually someone who was kind of very skeptical about the whole brand and the expensive dolls and all that. But I was completely converted. This is a lovely film. It reminds me of the kinds of films they used to make. National Velvet, the Shirley Temple movies, Meet Me in St. Louis. Just, you know, really lovely, warm. I mean, when's the last time a G-rated movie, live-action G-rated movie, held my interest and could
when was there even a G-rated movie?
Well, exactly. This is true. I mean, there's so many of these movies that are not really age-appropriate for kids.
Absolutely.
That, you know, yeah. And I feel like my mother could go with my daughter. It would be a wonderful bonding experience for them. It's just, it would stimulate a lot of interesting discussions about history. My daughter had a lot of questions about, you know, wow, did people really used to use typewriters? Where's the screen? You know, I mean, just things
and
like
it held
that.
Her
just,
attention.
Absolutely. She wants to put on a Kit Kittredge play now. Aww. And she never knew about Kit Kittredge a few days ago. So just a lovely, warm family film. The whole family can go to. There's even some stuff for boys, actually. I talked to a couple boys afterwards who liked some of the hobo stuff.
And cool enough for your daughter?
Yes. My daughter's 15, and she, you know, she did kind of go through the whole American Girl phase, which girls do, I guess, at 9 or 10 or whatever. And she had some dolls, and we read the books and all that stuff. And but she was, you know, kind of thinking I'm a little too cool for this, right. But sure, I'll go along because I like Abigail Breslin. Okay. And she enjoyed it a lot. And I have to say that I think Abigail Breslin is the real deal. She has shown herself, you know, a little sunshine. She was that, well, our hearts went out to her, a little bespectacled chubby kid. And now she's been in a couple other movies and she always shines. Yeah. She really is a quite a talent. And then to in terms of this movie, besides the fact that it was an interesting story, you have the rest of the cast, which is kind of like a real indie film cast. You have Stanley Tucci and Glenn Headley and John Cusack and you know, people that you admire and respect. Right. We adults admire
right.
and respect.
Exactly.
Playing real characters, you know, with some nuance and some dimension instead of sort of the cartoon or,
and
you know, cutout characters you see in
this
family
is actually,
films.
In contrast to something like Get Smart, this is a film that navigates those tonal shifts much more gracefully. I mean, you have some humor, some suspense, a little tragedy, but it's very warm. And I just want to add one more thing. You know, this is a very wholesome film and it's kind of, the word wholesome gets a bad rap, you know, but
the Doris Day segment is all about that.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, there's kids grow up so fast today, and you know who wants to see 8-year-olds wearing belly shirts and wanting to have tattoos and things
Absolutely.
Like that? I just feel like I think it's really lovely to have something.
It was refreshing,
so timeless, and such a throwback in a really nice way.
Yeah, and doesn't seem like it's, you know, cloyingly doing that. I mean, I sort of thought of this as the anti-Bratz movie.
Yeah.
The commercialization, the vapidness of
right.
you know that whole. Which there is so much of everywhere, TV and in our culture. This was an actual story. And it wasn't pandering. It wasn't
not pandering.
You know,
not
sentimental.
Talking down. And it also feels very timely because a lot of the, you know, these characters going through this economic crisis. And that's, you know, I could relate to that, having paid almost $5 a gallon for gas on the way over to the movie, thinking, God, that feels like, you know, today.
Right, right. So, the depression may not be.
Yeah,
have
it's just a really lovely, well-made, very nice film.
So you both believe the wholesomeness of it, the message. Kind of supersedes concerns about this is, you know, still a corporate driven.
I mean, you can
$105
make that
for
argument,
a doll in the
you know,
whole package.
The thing is, I didn't know this, but there's actually for every doll, there's a whole line of books.
Yes,
and they're not.
That's the
you know,
one good thing.
They're a little simplistically written, but they're written at like a second or third grade level. Mm-hmm. But they have stories,
a lot of historical facts.
It's very, very well researched, and these girls have to face challenges and overcome them, and they're proactive, and it's all about sort of girl empowerment.
It's empowerment,
and
yes, there are two prices. I agree. But, you know, there are ways you can get around that. I know kids who trade them, and at least they come with that book. So, you know, like if you want to buy the doll, you have to get a book.
You have to get
and there is now diversity, too.
Right.
It's
there's
evident
diversity. And apparently
that,
these dolls, which we don't have one, but apparently they last for several generations. They're very well made.
Yeah.
I mean, let me tell you, Barbie lasts for about 5 minutes in my house. The house, the head comes off, and that's about it.
My older daughter is 18, but she still has hers around.
We got to get to the next film, which is Brick Lane. A drama about a young Bangladeshi woman who is forced into an arranged marriage with a much older man in London. It stars Tanisha Chatterjee, Satish Kaushik, and Christopher Simpson, directed by Sarah Gavron, written by Laura Jones and Abby Morgan. And in this scene, Nazneen, played by Chatterjee, and Kareem, the younger assimilated man who delivers the material she sews, get to know each other.
I go out when I need to shop.
How long have you been living here?
16 years.
My mom came over when she was 17.
Me too.
For real? You look younger. You know, when I was young, if you wanted to be cool, you had to be something else. A bit white, a bit black, a bit something. Anything but Bangladeshi. Ekhon amra shob bhai. What?
You always stammer when you talk Bengali.
Only when I'm nervous.
Claudia, you want to go first?
Sure. I thought this was a sensitive and sometimes quite poetic film. It's a portrait of a Bangladeshi, one Bangladeshi Muslim in the East End of London. It's based on Monica Ali's 2003 novel, which was very well received. And it's a touching personal story. Sometimes the film feels a little slow, as you can almost hear it a little bit there. But I think it's mostly saved by the excellent lead performance of Tanisha Chatterjee, who we just heard. She has a very expressive face. And, you know, at first the character of her husband, Satish, who's played by Satish Kaushik, is he comes off a little bit like a one-dimensional buffoon. And then as the tale unfolds, he grows more sympathetic. And there's this absolutely beautiful closing scene, which mm-hmm. I was really moved by. And her, you know, you kind of get from the photography, she leads this cloistered, sheltered life. And it's sort of symbolized by the physical confinement in her small rooms and narrow streets and all of that and muted colors. And then she also becomes empowered in a different way as an adult. But there's some striking visuals, very, you know, I thought beautiful traditional music. I really liked it.
I think I mostly liked it. It's sort of a bit of an homage to Brief Encounter in some ways. And there's actually a scene where she's catching a glimpse of Brief Encounter on the TV.
Right.
Although it's not that. It's other things, too. It is, as you said, more a story about kind of her path to self-empowerment. And I completely agree with you, Claudia, about the husband. Just what an interesting dimensional character he becomes, and he just really does strike you as this buffoon in the beginning. But there's little bits of dimensionality that emerge as the story goes along, and it's lovely. It's beautifully acted. I wish it had gone maybe just a little bit further.
Yeah,
maybe just a little more.
Yeah.
But
It was absorbing and it was moving. There's a little, the narrative, I think, kind of, or some of the dialogue got a little trite.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an absolutely fantastic film. I think it's a good film.
Yes.
Certainly, you know, it keeps your interest.
And what's good, Claudia, is you mentioned that Ms. Chatterjee, she acts really well with her face because the film hinges a lot on just her expressions because she's silent. And
it's lovely the way she does. She has these gestures, these little gesticulations where she'll cover her head with the veil all the time. Just
and then
tugging
after a while,
and
she starts to
open up
a
little
bit. Yeah, you see
her
hair.
Sometimes you see
her
without it.
Yeah.
That was a lovely touch. It was it was really nicely designed and shot, I thought.
Yeah, and I like the sort of back and forth between the flashbacks and the contemporary. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it got a little bit repetitive where you'd see her sister running back in Bangladesh. And I was a little vague about exactly what happened to the sister, too. Mm-hmm. I thought that was in the narrative had a little flaw there.
Yeah,
it was
a little confusing.
Yeah.
But I actually thought the way that the contemporary daughters was portrayed was I really liked that.
I thought the daughters were fantastic.
I thought that was really authentic.
They felt
very,
very
real to me.
Yeah.
Okay. The film is Brick Lane, opening this weekend, rated PG-13 from Sony Pictures Classics. Our next film, I think we have time for at least one more, is Without the King, a portrait of Swaziland, the last absolute monarchy in the world, and the disparity between the opulent life of its king and the rampant poverty of its people. Without the King is directed by Michael Skolnick. And Claudia, you saw it, and I liked it.
Yeah, I didn't know that was the last absolute monarchy in the world. And in the last 50 years, Africa, of course, has been shedding much of that. I didn't know really anything about Swaziland. And what was this particular character was really interesting. He came to power as a boy. His father had ruled since they had gained independence from England in 1968. He was one of 250 children chosen to be king. And there were 110 wives, by the way. So at least that made it a little bit easier to bear 25 or 250 children. But
I guess.
but you know, early on, you see these photos of him with heads of state and dignitaries like Yasser Arafat and Colin Powell and Prince Charles and Castro and Gaddafi. And then all of a sudden you see him with Michael Jackson and you get the idea what this guy is sort of about. And then a few minutes later, one of his 22 children is doing a rap song. And so, you know, he's all about sort of this kind of materialism and opulence, and then the contrast of the extreme poverty and the fact that there's this growing political activism is really interesting.
Okay, well, we can't leave without talking about the LA Film Festival, which opened on Thursday, the 14th annual Los Angeles Film Festival. It runs through Sunday, the 29th, at numerous venues in Westwood. More than 100,000 people are expected to attend these showcases of the best of American and international independent cinema, which will screen over 175 narrative features, documentaries, shorts, and music videos. You can find out more on its website, lafilmfest.com. Lael, you must attend?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is the third year it's being held in Westwood, which was sort of an experiment to kind of centralize it more. And what's interesting is, along with that physical recentralization, it's starting to kind of centralize its own voice. And it's now including some big Hollywood premieres. The movie Wanted, the Angelina Jolie movie.
That was an interesting choice.
Yeah, interesting choice, sort of unusual. Hellboy 2 is closing it. You know, and then there's some old, wonderful indie, some classics like Cassavetes' Shadows, the Robert Kramer picture Ice, and Kramer's counterculture film Milestones is also playing. There's a wonderful film that I'm dying to see, Man on the Wire, which is about Philippe Petit, who walked between the World Trade Center towers in the 70s. That's gotten a lot of good press out of Sundance. There's also some really nice tributes. Antonio Banderas will be talking about his career. Don Cheadle is getting an award there. There's really just a nice collection of sort of independent, foreign and domestic, and even some bigger name films. So
where does the LA Film Festival stand in terms of
Cannes,
the pantheon of
Sundance
film festivals, in terms of the ones that get a little more publicity?
You know, I mean, I think if it weren't being held here, it probably wouldn't get as much attention.
Yeah,
but
I don't think it's at that level of that pantheon, but I think certainly the fact that it's in L.A., you know, it's not quite at the level of the New York Film Festival.
I mean,
but
of the festivals we have here, we have the AFI Festival, we still have the Hollywood Film Festival, don't we?
And there's a lot. There's an Indian Film Festival.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them. But I think this is one of the very best. It's definitely a very well-respected festival, and it has now encompassed a wide range of films, and many of them have gone on to get distribution, you know, out of this as well.
And it runs through Sunday in Westwood, the LA Film Festival. We should mention that Air Talk with Larry Mantle travels to the Beverly Hills Public Library on Tuesday, June 24th at 6:30 for a one-hour discussion about the proposed West Side extension of the subway, or the subway to the sea. Hope you can make it.